Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Back to Lucy and Desi, although we're going to get to Lucy and Desi again. I got sidetracked again on this part. I promise we're going to get back to Sammy. We're going to get back to Kim Novak. We're going to get back to Lucy. Everybody. In one of the episodes, I think it was last episode, I know we've talked about Bob Harrison, the confidential guy. And I think I've talked before, maybe briefly, about one of its best sources was Francesca DeScaffa, and she was the ex-wife of the actor Bruce Cabot. And she had been in a couple of films herself, but she told Harrison that she had a large circle of Hollywood friends, access to their secrets. She said, if there's some secrets I don't know, I'll find them out, even if I have to have an affair with the man involved. And it was her who provided Confidential with the story of how Errol Flynn would direct amorous couples into a certain bedroom in his house, then unbeknownst to them, invite friends to watch through a two-way mirror. I've talked about Errol Flynn on here before. I've talked about his horrible things that he did to underage girls. But he was definitely also a guy that enjoyed other men. And one of those men is a tragic story. And it's a guy named Ross Alexander. And Ross always played the best friend. He was Warner Brothers' favorite second lead. Their first favorite was Dick Powell. Well, no, I guess Dick Powell was more of a lead. But he did play with Dick Powell in Flirtation Walk, but he was also with Errol Flynn in Captain Blood. And his story is really tragic because in January 1937, he walked out to a barn near his Hollywood home. And this same barn was where his 22-year-old former and late wife, actress Alida Friel, used a .22 caliber rifle to shoot herself to death on December 6, 1935. So this is 13 months later. Ross carried the same firearm, took his own life with it. And between these apparent suicides, Ross married actress Ann Nagel. There's nothing to suggest that the reinvestigation of Alida's death by California Governor Frank Merriam at the request of New Jersey Governor Harold Hoffman, because Alida was from Jersey, had anything to do with Ross's taking his life in the barn. And it's funny enough, Warner then needed to find somebody to replace Ross. And what they did was they found this guy out on Santa Catalina Island who was doing spring training games for the Chicago Cubs. They went out there and did a screen test of him. He was a very capable replacement. Later became president of the Screen Actors Guild, governor of California, president of the United States, Ronald Reagan. It was because of Ross Alexander's death. Now, what about his wife, Alida Friel? Okay, here's one obituary. Failure to repeat her New York stage success in motion pictures drove Alida Friel, 28, not 22, to suicide early today, her film actor husband Ross Alexander told police. After a quarrel with Alexander, she shot herself in the temple, police said. She died in a hospital shortly afterward. After we retired last night, my wife arose and went to the gun rack and took up a .22 rifle, Alexander told police. We had been quarreling over a trifling matter. She was irritated over some screen tests in which she failed recently. I heard a shot, but I thought she was bluffing. Then I heard another shot. Alexander said he and his butler found the actress prostrate in the yard of their Hollywood Hills home. Married in 1924, the couple came to Hollywood 3 years ago from New York, where each had played important stage roles. Since then, Alexander has become a successful film juvenile leading man. His wife, however, had been unable to obtain recognition in pictures. Ms. Friel's last Broadway appearance was in the play Double Door, which ended a successful run in 1934. She was the daughter of Dr. and Mrs. William Friel of Jersey City. Her stage career began shortly after graduation from Smith College. Now, that was one obituary. What about the New York Times had something slightly different? They also said that she was 28. Former New York actress and wife of Ross Alexander, film leading man, committed suicide by shooting herself through the temple, police reported today. Her husband said she was disappointed in her career. The pretty stage player took a small caliber rifle from a gun rack in her home. Detective R. Burdick said, and fired the fatal shot while her husband slept. She died early today at emergency hospital. Alexander told the detectives that he and his wife had a, quote, small spat during the evening. She was despondent, Alexander added, because screen tests on which she built high hopes turned out unsuccessful. From his bedroom, Alexander said he heard a shot and, rushing out to the yard, stumbled over his wife's prostate form. The couple was married in New York after a backstage romance. The actress played leading roles in several Eastern stock companies while her husband was cast in numerous Broadway productions, including the latter. Alexander came to Hollywood 3 years ago, winning recognition as a juvenile leading man. He is playing in Captain Blood after finishing work in A Midsummer's Night Dream at the Warner Brothers studio. Ms. Friel is the daughter of Dr. and Mrs. William Friel. Dr. Friel, a practicing physician, was in telephone communication with his son-in-law yesterday, but said he had learned little more about his daughter's death than he had read in the newspapers. His plans regarding the funeral were uncertain. Ms. Friel was born in Jersey City, received her early education at the Bergen School for Girls. She was graduated from Smith College. For several years, she played in the legitimate theater. Her last performance was in The Double Door more than 2 years ago. Soon afterwards, she married Mr. Alexander. So apparently Hollywood is not legitimate theater. But it's very interesting how it sounds like the husband was not really communicating with the family very well about what really happened. A small spat is different, and that was a quote. We don't have the quote-unquote butler, and I'm not sure how they could afford a butler necessarily, but there was no mention of a butler in the New York Times obituary. So I just find it odd. Was she murdered? I don't know. I mean, his professional life was in disarray. His personal life was in disarray. And he was deeply in debt, which would also indicate that they probably didn't have a butler. And it had been reported that Alexander used the same gun his wife had shot herself with. Other sources, however, claim that while both used 22 caliber bullets, Ross used a pistol while Alita used a rifle. And his final film, Ready, Willing, and Able, was released posthumously. According to Henry Fonda, who was best man at the wedding, she took her life after confirming that Alexander had been having affairs with other women and not because of her career troubles. No. Ross Alexander was gay. Possibly bisexual. His name was changed, as, you know, a lot of actors did. It was in order to create an image that would please most American filmgoers. His real name was Alexander Ross Smith Jr., upper middle class New Yorker. He was taken from Brooklyn to Rochester, New York, where he first appeared in school plays. He came back to New York City to pursue acting, and his career took off. Rising in the ranks of young, handsome leads on Broadway, even in the more live and let live atmosphere of Broadway, Ross Alexander maintained that he was married to an older woman with whom he had a daughter. Where did that come from? Nobody could ever find a marriage license. Nobody could ever find a birth certificate for a child. In early 1932, Alexander became acquainted with another up-and-coming Broadway actor, Franco Tone. We have mentioned him before. They fell in love and lived openly as lovers in New York. Their relationship ended only with the inevitable signing of top Broadway performers to film studio contracts. Alexander went first to Hollywood, but it was Tone who scored in films at MGM, and then Alexander was signed by Warner Brothers in 1934. Alexander had the whole package, right? He was good-looking, athletic, great voice. Film studios wanted this because people were talking now in movies. And he could even sing. Flirtation Walk, he was singing. In Here Comes Carter, he was a capable comedian. He got great notices for his role in Captain Blood and I Married a Doctor. In a film that featured the star-making debuts of Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, Ross is the one who stood out as Captain Blood's friend Jeremy Pitt. And Alexander also stood out with Errol Flynn personally. They started an affair during the making of Captain Blood and remained close friends after their affair ended with the end of filming on Captain Blood. One of the things that I wonder is if this butler was actually a lover. Now, Ross Alexander being bisexual or gay proved too much for Jack Warner and his publicity department, because Alexander, like, cruised men rather openly, and he was caught all the time by the police department. And the LAPD back then obviously worked with the studios, and nothing was ever published in the newspaper. The arrests were expunged from LAPD records, but they kept having to bail Alexander out of all these jail terms. So Warner Brothers said, okay, hey, you're going to have to marry somebody. So enter the wife, Miss Friel. And Ross had known her, obviously, from Broadway. And they got married in early January 1934. So they weren't even married that long. And Henry Fonda, like I said before, was the best man. And it looked normal, right? But then December 35, that's when she takes a shotgun and kills herself. And apparently she left a note that said that she felt inadequate as a wife to Alexander. Was it because, again, of this quote-unquote butler? And then she realized he was gay. But the thing is, there was all this news coverage about her death. And then Alexander still hadn't stopped cruising for guys. So Jack Warner said, okay, I'm not going to make you a star anymore. Basically, from early 1936, so a month after it happened, when she killed herself, he just got B pictures. So his career was going into decline. And 1936 marked the point of no return. He had arrived at Warner Brothers in 1934, and he admired the work and artistry of Betty Davis. And he wanted to work with her and arranged to meet her at the studio so he could convince her to co-star in a film with him so that she could see that he could do well in dramatic parts and be a good co-star. And lo and behold, Franco Tone became the leading man in Dangerous. And that's the film for which Davis won her first Oscar. So then Alexander was like, oh, I want to see Betty Davis. Because he really wanted to convince her to co-star with him in the film. And this contact led Betty Davis at first to think that he was after her romantically so that he could use her to boost his image as a heterosexual lover. She wasn't attracted to him at all, although she did fall in love with Tone, to the point that Tone's fiancée, Joan Crawford, visited the set of Dangerous often when she heard that Davis wanted to initiate an affair with Tone. Davis at the time was married to Ham Nelson, and his nickname was Ham, but Betty Davis said his nickname was Oscar, and so that's where she coined the term Oscar over the Academy Awards. But Ham believed that Alexander's obsession with his wife was of a romantic sexual one. So then he found out that maybe it wasn't. So then he started humiliating Alexander for his sexual orientation in front of studio personnel. But Alexander still kept going to Davis. So then Ham Nelson came to the studio and punched Alexander in the face in front of studio personnel. So this, of course, because Betty Davis is the queen of Warner Brothers, this really sent Alexander's career into decline, especially with the B films that he was given. And Betty had been having affairs. I mean, one was with Howard Hughes. And she said, at that time, you know, by that time I was married to Ham only in name. We were usually separated because of his work or my work or both. When we were together, there was nothing left between us. Any happy days we had were in our memories almost entirely before we married. The terrible distance when we were together was harder to bear than when we were apart. We no longer communicated with each other at all, and our sex life had disappeared. A woman who's been with just one man for a long time is practically a virgin again. That's from her book. In the divorce documents, it was funny because Ham said that he was divorcing her because she spent too much time reading. Betty said about an affair that she was having at that time with Howard Hughes. She said, I was the only one who ever brought Howard Hughes to a sexual climax, or so he said at the time. No. Of course, you don't know. I mean, it's true. That is to say, it's true that he said it, or let's say I believed him when he told me that. I was wildly naive at the time. It may have been his regular seduction gambit. Anyway, it worked with me and was cheaper than buying gifts. But Howard Hughes, he was not. I liked sex in a way that was considered unbecoming for a woman in my time. The way I felt was only considered appropriate for a man. It was both a physical and an emotional need. Of course, it had advantages in the pleasures it brought me, no question about that, but it also made me a victim. Well, when Ham found out that Betty was having an affair with Howard Hughes, he tried to tape record Betty and Howard Hughes having sex. And he didn't really have very much money. So when Betty and Ham finally got divorced, Warner Brothers had to give the now ex-husband some money. But Alexander Ross, I mean, he had no chance. And that first anniversary of his wife's death just left him in grief. You know? And so he took the pistol and killed himself. But the aftermath of his death was tragic because, like I said, he had got married to a woman named Ann Nagle, who's an actress. She was the person who discovered his body. And the trauma of her husband's suicide triggered her alcoholism, which not only ruined her film career, it ended her life early. And she died at 50, destitute. In later years, Betty Davis acknowledged her sorrow at the way she treated Ross. She never came to psychological or emotional terms completely about his death. And his former lover, Tone, dated and married several women, fathered children with actress Jean Wallace. But his relationships with women were often tortured and violent. During his marriage to Joan Crawford, he succumbed to alcoholism and beat her during many alcohol binges. But it was Crawford who took care of Tone financially, medically during the last years of his life when he had no one in his life to care for him. And I've talked about Franco Tone one other time. It was 2 years ago. So since I hadn't talked about him, I talked about him a little bit back 2 years ago. But since it's, you know, part of what I'm doing today, I thought maybe I'd repeat it a little bit. His career as an actor may not really have survived the test of time. I mean, he is great in Mutiny on the Bounty. But he is a guy who caught the eye of Crawford and Davis. And supposedly he, if you've watched the feud on FX or whatever, he might be the spark that kicked off the rivalry between Davis and Crawford. Because Betty said, "I fell in love with him professionally and privately. Everything about him reflected his elegance from his name to his manners." But Betty didn't get him. Joan did. And David said he was madly in love with her. They met each day for lunch. He would return to the set, his face covered in lipstick. I was jealous, of course. And he became Joan's second, possibly third husband. We're still not sure about the first husband and whether or not he existed. But they got married in 1935. And they would divorce 4 years later. And 2 years before Betty Davis died, she gave a 1987 interview to British gossip writer Michael Thornton, where she said, "Hey, she took him, Joan, took him from me. She did it coldly, deliberately, and with complete ruthlessness. I have never forgiven her for that and never will." I mean, that's what everybody remembers Tone for. The wedge between Crawford and Davis. You know, Betty Davis thought that he had been stolen by Joan. But Joan did take care of him. And the feud is set in 1962. That's the year when Davis and Crawford made their only film together, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It was hugely popular. And it resurrected the career of both stars. And the making of the film, though, was traumatic because of what had happened 30 years earlier. Even in the earliest days of their acquaintance, Davis viewed Crawford with contempt, believing she was a woman who used sex to advance her career. And Joan Crawford was one who freely admitted to that. But Betty Davis said she slept with every star at MGM, of both sexes. And that was true. I mean, most of Crawford's leading men had sex with her. And she had sex with women, too. Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich, Barbara Stanwyck, Marilyn Monroe. And Crawford was infatuated with Davis, but Betty Davis, firmly heterosexual, said no. But Davis, this feud began when Davis had just been cast by her studio in Dangerous. And that was like her best actress Oscar, her first one. And it was kind of a makeup, if you will. because the year before, she probably should have been nominated for Of Human Bondage. She got really good reviews. But when the Academy nominations appeared, only three performances were named. Three. Can you imagine if we only had three? Claudette Colbert and It Happened One Night. Davis claimed that that part had been offered to her. Grace Moore in One Night of Love. And Norma Shearer in The Barretts of Wimpole Street. In her book, Betty Davis claimed that she was nominated too, but that's not true. There was some press protest at her mission and talk of a write-in campaign where voters might add Davis to the ballots. But here's the thing. She got loaned out by Warners for the movie, but Jack Warner didn't want to let her out to do it because he said, this part is not for you. People will hate you when they watch it. But she went to Jack Warner's office every single day for 6 months until he finally said, fine. So she did it. But he was right, though. A large part of the public was horrified by the squalor of the character's life and the way that Betty Davis conveyed it. They saw no reason to like a character not liked by her film. But also what had happened that same year was the Screen Actors Guild had gained membership. More people had joined it. And so the Academy for the year 1934, only 95 actors remained as members of the Academy. So you had 95 people voting. And how many of those 95 do you think were under contract at Warner Brothers and were heavily pressured by their studio not to vote for Betty Davis? And Betty Davis said, I was cheated. And she said, my failure to receive the award created a scandal that gave me more publicity than if I had won it. Syndicated columnists spread the word foul and the public stood behind me like an army. Not since that decision in 1934 was so cavalier a verdict allowed to take place. Price Waterhouse was asked to step in the next year to count the vote, which they have done ever since. But Warner Brothers was right. If you watch Of Human Bondage, there's not a minute where Betty Davis is not just like loathsome. And Warner's was famous for working their contract players hard. So in 1935, think about this. Betty Davis got paid $1,200 a week, and she made five movies. Five. And that's crazy. In that same 1935, Joan Crawford made two movies at a far higher salary. Katharine Hepburn made three. So Davis had good reason to feel like she was being exploited and neglected at the same time for her studio. And when she won the Oscar for Dangerous in March 1936, the studio leased the use of her face for breakfast cereal ads, refused to increase her salary, and put her in three really bad movies. So her career, she was depressed. Her marriage was clearly over. It's possible that by 1936 she had had two abortions. And so she said, you know what? Warners, take it and leave it. I'm not going to do anything. So the studio suspended her, and she quit. And she took her mom, they flew from L.A. to Vancouver, took the train across the country in Canada, and sailed from Montreal to London. And she said, I'm going to make some movies here in England. And then Warner Brothers blocked her from doing that. But the thing is that, so they blocked her, and then it went to trial in London, and it was this big, huge spectacle. But the thing is the fans fell back in love with Betty Davis. But Betty Davis never forgave Joan Crawford for Frank O'Tone. I mean, she had been married for 3 years, right? And within a few days of commencing work on Dangerous, she won in Tone. And she said, if the truth be known, I fell in love with Frank O'Tone, professionally and privately. Everything about him reflected his elegance, like I said. And when Crawford first entertained Tone at her Hollywood home, he found her in the solarium, tanned from head to foot and stark naked, and according to friends and neighbors, Tone didn't emerge from the solarium until nightfall. But Betty Davis wanted Tone. And one time, this is how the story goes, Harry Joe Brown, the crew supervisor in Dangerous, was astonished to see Betty Davis on her knees, pleasuring Tone in one of their dressing rooms. When they saw me, they didn't seem to give a damn. But Betty Davis was not able to get Tone away from Crawford. Now, there's an interesting story about Bette Davis. And it goes back to before she was even really a professional actress. And it had long-lasting consequences. It is quite possibly the reason that she did not get the role in Gone with the Wind that she really, really wanted. She was in London having this spat with Warner Brothers, and that's when Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind was published. It became this international bestseller. And there had been some word of the book before publication. And Bette Davis believed that Jack Warner had promised her he would get an option on the novel with her in mind. And when she actually read the book, Bette Davis was even more strongly of the opinion that it was meant for her. But David Selznick ended up buying the rights to the book for $50,000, which was not really that huge of a sum in those days. So she was really upset at the studio for, you can't spend more than $50,000? But what she didn't know was that as early as 1935, one of the producers at Warner's and Jack Warner, they were looking at the play Jezebel. And it wasn't as popular as Gone with the Wind, but it was cheaper. And so she ended up playing in Jezebel. And that opened in March 1938, by which time Gone with the Wind had hardly advanced in a little less than 2 years. And some reckon that Julie Marsden was going to get Scarlett O'Hara. But David O. Selznick was highly irritated at the way Warner's had stolen her on a project. And here's the thing. Was it Selznick who didn't want Bette Davis in Gone with the Wind? Because Selznick was still considering two master plans for making Gone with the Wind. One included MGM. They would deliver Clark Gable and $1.25 million in funds, in return for which Lowe's, the parent company, would distribute the film. Or Warner Brothers would package Errol Flynn and Bette Davis and offer $2.1 million in funds. And Selznick, he couldn't figure out which way to go. Though Bette Davis later declared that she couldn't imagine Errol Flynn playing Rhett Butler. Would Bette Davis have been great as Scarlett? She could have carried it off. She might have been great with Clark Gable. They never actually made a movie together. But Lee, Vivian Lee, was 5 years younger. She was far less known, had the benefit of novelty, and gave the impression of youth. And Bette Davis really couldn't do that. And Bette Davis was already established as like a horrible person in the movies. She played like that kind of character. Vivian Leigh was fresh. She could be romantic. And Bette Davis had this thing that cast a shadow on all her parts. But was it Selznick who made that decision? No. I think it's where you have to go way, way back in time. Rochester, New York. And Bette Davis gets this job with the George Cukor Company. And his company was famous for the realism of its work. And Cukor himself took on Davis and quickly asked her to understudy in a play called Broadway. Okay. Well, the first actress was injured, and Davis went on one night. And one of the six chorus girls you see from time to time in the play comes quietly down a stairway from the dressing rooms. She takes out a revolver and shoots him, the villain. You don't know who she is or why. It's just great theater. So this Wednesday matinee, this young girl playing the part turned her ankle and couldn't go on. So Cukor said, I asked this blonde girl, Davis, do you think you can do it? And she said, yes. And I ran her through it. She had no lines. That night I saw her performance and she crept downstairs with her baby face and took out the revolver, and suddenly there was Bette Davis. She shot the man with this intensity. She willed him dead, and people were impressed. But they noticed that Davis would not take direction. And Cukor said, there's nothing personal. They simply couldn't find other parts for her. But it had consequences. Because this George guy, he was one of the best film directors of Bette's time. He was also the director with a reputation for handling actresses with finesse. He made 10 films with Katharine Hepburn, 3 with Joan Crawford, but he never directed Bette Davis. The closest they came was Gone with the Wind. Why? Because George Cukor said, I don't want to work with Bette Davis. And the funny thing is, the chef's kiss to this is that after they decided that it was going to be Vivian Leigh and Clark Gable, He left the production and they brought in Victor Fleming. I don't know if she ever recovered from, I mean, she got her Oscar with Jezebel, but. And I think Gone with the Wind, it came out in 1939, right? That's why I beat Wizard of Oz. And then at that time when it was filming and stuff, Bette Davis, basically, like I said, she had done this intense period of work. She was successful. She was the leading movie actress of the day, but she wanted a vacation. So she goes back to New England where she's from. So you have this great star, Bette Davis, exhausted. She goes to New Hampshire and Vermont. And she gets there during the fall season. It's gorgeous. And Betty's known a lot of Hollywood guys, some of them world famous, but she's tired of the way that they speak of love when they mean, hey, self-love. But then one day she's in a hotel in New Hampshire and she meets a new guy. His name is Arthur Farnsworth. He's handsome. He's from an old New England family. Maybe. Betty calls him Farney. And he's the real thing. Completely different. So he flies himself. He goes on missions. And she thinks, maybe he's a secret agent. But she's too spellbound to push her questions. The attraction builds, but uncertainty lingers. There's calls from Warners to return. Betty's in two minds. Farnsworth could be Cary Grant. He loves her, she thinks. But he's uninterested in her big life. Sometimes she has to remind him that she's a star. But they get married. December 1940. But she doesn't ever know that much about him. Betty begins to be bored with him. She's back at work again, of course, absorbed in new films and sometimes flirting with her directors. Farney comes and goes. And then on 23rd of August, 1943, while walking on Hollywood Boulevard, he cries out and collapses. No one's quite sure whether Betty's there at the time or not. 2 days later, he's dead. There's an investigation, of course, and emerges that perhaps Farney suffered a head injury sometime before, one that took time to develop. It's never been explained. There were some who wondered if Betty had been involved. On one occasion, she admitted pushing him earlier on the fatal day so that he had a fall. And this occurs on the eve of the making of Mr. Skeffington that starts delayed a week for the funeral and the inquiry. And then Betty goes back to work in a haze of guilt and confusion. She remembers that they had quarreled just before the bad day on Hollywood Boulevard. But she can't get over the way that this guy died in that street. Was he killed? Oh, we do not know. But going back to Bob Harrison, it was DeScaffa who funneled the story of Robert Mitchum attending a party at Charles Laughton's, taking off his clothes, slathering himself with ketchup, and then declaring it a masquerade party with him dressed as a hamburger. That was the sanitized version. In a 1988 TV documentary, the real story came out. It was Mitchum putting the ketchup on his penis and asking Laughton and a producer friend whether the gay guys would want to eat a hot dog. I mean, Confidential was crazy. They had this source named Ronnie Quillen. And she was a party girl, in the words of the LA Times. And she submitted a story about an affair she claimed to have had 10 years earlier with Desi Arnaz. There we go, a little Desi. But Harrison loved the piece so much that Quillen then set up Harrison with call girls who had similar dirt on other stars. And additional sources reportedly included Dean Martin's children's governess, a bartender who offered information on Joan Crawford, a neighbor of actor Sonny Tufts who reported on Tufts' romantic dalliances, a piece about Frank Sinatra's weekend exploits with a female partner, which insisted that he liked to boost his sexual energy by eating bowls of Wheaties. This was provided by the woman herself. There was even a Los Angeles policeman who was believed to have sold stories to Harrison off the blotter. But it wasn't just the sources that infuriated Hollywood's powers that be. It was the magazine's methods. Because Harrison deployed a crew of private detectives. One report estimated he spent $10,000 a month to verify stories. And he linked up to DeScaffa with a private eye named H.L. von Wittenberg, who gave her a wristwatch recorder so that she could tape conversations. And Harrison ordered von Wittenberg to wire Ronnie Quillen as well and then asked her to take actress Elizabeth Scott to lunch to confirm a rumor that she was a lesbian. Even von Wittenberg was repelled. "I think this work stinks," he claims to have told Harrison. But Confidential's final indignity in Hollywood was the way Harrison embraced his role as a scandal king. He lived in a suite at New York's Hotel Madison on 58th Street, wore bespoke suits, a double-breasted white cashmere overcoat, had his monogram shirts made by Sulca. He drove a long white Cadillac convertible, and he went virtually nowhere without a buxom woman adorning his arm. He liked them tall, blonde, and beautiful. And they all were. For a time, Zsa Zsa Gabor pursued him, according to a confidant of Harrison's who said Gabor once spread her bank books across the table to impress him. But Harrison wasn't interested. He preferred showgirls he could dominate, women who contributed to his flamboyant image. And his steadiest girlfriend was a beautiful showgirl named June Frew, who took to wearing sweaters embroidered with a large H and who occasionally claimed to be Harrison's wife. Harrison always denied it. Harrison's attorney said that Frew would sometimes call him up at 3 or 4 in the morning and start yelling and cursing at him that he was responsible for Harrison not marrying her and that the attorney was standing in the way. She and Harrison were actually banished from El Morocco after a screaming fight in the middle of the club. But it wasn't Harrison's soft-heartedness that would eventually plague him. It was his success. He had created such high expectations for gossip among his readers that he needed new and better sources as the months went on. In the summer of 1954, he made a recruiting trip to Los Angeles, came up with this gaffe. But Harrison realized that his visits were too infrequent. He needed a permanent listing post in Hollywood. Well, he had a 26-year-old niece, Marjorie, who had decided to resettle in California with her husband, Fred Mead. And so when she set out for California, her uncle asked her if she could take care of a few things. As Marjorie recalls it, he wanted to run more first-person stories, and he hoped that she and her husband might gather and verify them. So Marjorie and Fred Mead, they arrived in L.A. in January 1955. They thought, hey, this confidential work would be a nice sideline. But Fred's fiberglass business began failing. So Harrison gave them $150,000 to start Hollywood Research, Inc. The bureau, which Harrison incorporated that July, consisted of Marjorie and Fred. Its primary function was to collect affidavits from sources and send them on to New York, where they would be converted into articles. One source explained that she'd been tipped off to Mead by a restaurateur who said that Mead wanted to buy stories on stars. And when the woman provided him with material, Mead called the New York office to see if it was usable, then provided her with a check and a contract. "Later, I saw him talking to an old creep who looked like he'd come off Skid Row," the woman said. "When I saw that happening, I decided that he would take just about any story." But the Meads didn't have to troll for very long. Marjorie says that certain Hollywood insiders, out of fear or out of the excitement of being associated with Confidential, actually welcomed them. Mike Connolly, a powerful columnist at The Hollywood Reporter and an acquaintance of Harrison's, befriended them, gave them stories, and encouraged people to talk to them. And Marjorie suspected it was because Connolly, who was gay and often reported on Hollywood's homosexual community, was afraid of being outed by Confidential. Another old friend of Harrison's, a band leader named Eddie LeBaron, who had married an heir to the Smith Corona typewriter fortune, invited them into a social set and gave the Meads a certain cachet. Soon enough, people started approaching them, often minor stars spreading gossip about themselves by relating stories that weren't necessarily flattering, but that would get them ink. And that first year, by Fred's estimate, the Meads collected 750 leads for stories. But not everyone in Hollywood embraced the Meads. The studios definitely didn't. They had a lot invested in the stars that Confidential was going after. There was a tremendous pressure from Hollywood. And Harrison's attorney said he believed that the studio brass were behind a probe in a Confidential by Manhattan District Attorney Frank Hogan, who was investigating charges that the magazine extorted money to kill stories. Does that sound familiar? Still going on. As early as 1955, The Hollywood Reporter was writing that industry executives had been meeting to retaliate against the scandal magazines. One private detective said he had been contacted by a studio security chief to consult with a producer director The director wanted to know what it would take to kill Confidential. And this private detective would later testify that he said it would need $50,000 from each studio and a $50,000 expense fund, $300,000 in all, to recruit former FBI agents to investigate the magazine and disprove its stories. And the plan was considered, but it was never executed. Because the heads of the studios thought a project of this might boomerang. But Harrison just kept going at it and kept going at it. In 1956, Harrison and his managing editor and a singer named Gene Courtney went to the Dominican Republic so that Harrison could look into a piece on an alleged new miracle drug. And he was in the lobby of this hotel in Santo Domingo. And he met and exchanged words with Richard Weldy, who was an animal trapper and safari guide, whose ex-wife had subsequently married John Wayne. And Confidential had once done a story on this woman, Pilar Paulette. And this guy, Richard Weldy, was really angry about it. So the next morning, Harrison and the people that he was with sat on an expedition to the Dominican jungle. And no sooner had they entered the bush than they encountered Weldy, who, as the story went on, shouted at Harrison, "I was never so surprised in my life." And he told reporters that he tried to intervene, but he tripped on a rock, heard a shot ring out, and saw Harrison wounded and bleeding. And Weldy escaped. And by the time he reached town, there was fog had rolled in, and so rescue teams had to wait until morning. Publisher edited by rifle was the headline in the Los Angeles Mirror News. I mean, Harrison said he forgave Weldy. He said he cannot be blamed for what happened. But largely because of the attention the incident received, Harrison was invited to appear on Nightbeat, and that was a show hosted by Mike Wallace. And when Wallace questioned Harrison about whether the shooting had been a publicity stunt, the publisher pulled up his shirt to show the bullet hole. But the camera zeroed in on a large mole instead, making it look as if Harrison had been shot with an elephant gun. Before he left for his trip, Harrison had promised reporters that the next issue of Confidential would be the shot heard around the world. Weldy later claimed that he never shot Harrison. I wouldn't waste a bullet on him. But according to one story, Weldy was put on Confidential's payroll. In the next episode, we are going to talk about what brought down Confidential. We're going to get back to Sammy. We're going to get back to Kim Novak. We're going to get back to gangsters. And we're going to get back to Lucy and Desi, too. I'll talk to you guys later.